Hi, Sex and the City fans. Megan McKeever here. Check out my podcast, Cosmos and the City, where I'll be watching through the entire series of Sex and the City with a slew of fabulous guests. Each week, we'll be talking through everything from who wore what and why to the hottie of the week. So grab a drink and join me on my journey. Thanks, and be sure to subscribe to Cosmos and the City in iTunes or your favorite podcasting app.
This is a Boardwalk Audio podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Improv Obsession Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Perlstein, and today we've got Farley Elliott on the show. You all may know Farley from Squeeze, Scandal, Comrades. That was the former host of the Manifesto show, now run by Penguins on the Playground. I think it's the best indie show in town. You should check it out. You also might know Farley from his writing about food for Eater LA and from his book, Los Angeles Street Food. This is a continuation of my conversation about not doing improv anymore. If you didn't listen, last week I asked Billy Merritt, should I quit improv? And I had a similar conversation with Farley, since he brings the perspective of someone who did stop doing improv for the most part. He has some really thoughtful points on dissecting what the value of doing improv really is. And again, this is just a continuing conversation on this topic. It may continue for a little longer. I might have a couple of more episodes on it, but it's just food for thought. If you have opinions on improv, if it's good or bad, if it's wrong or right, the community, should you stick with it? Should you quit? When do you stop? Let me know. I'm interested to hear what other people think about this conundrum. Shoot me an email at improvobsession@gmail.com. I'll definitely check it out. I'm interested to know how other people think about this. But we also talk extensively about improv in this one too. And Farley is really smart in that he brings up how he was trying to break down improv into simpler, concrete steps that would make him a better improviser, kind of move away from the frou-frou talk about it and actually go into a process and method of learning and getting better. And I think that's really great. Also, Farley and I talk about ramen and pokey because Farley knows really good food and he recommended some good stuff that I'm excited to check out. Last, real quick, I want to thank you people, you listeners, for adding some reviews on iTunes. If you have a minute, please add a review on iTunes. I really appreciate it. I guess it helps it get more seen and heard. I found that to be true. But yeah, anyway, go do it if you have the time. Big Erm Alex, he says he likes the podcast because it makes his obsession with improv seem normal. Yeah, man, we're normal. They're weird. Not the people who don't like it are weird. Michael Sonowski. So Snowski, I'm going to say, thanks for taking the time to do this, is what he said. Hey, no, thank you for taking the time to listen. Joe, with a bunch of numbers, he says he's a fan of Mary Holland and in her episode. I think that's great. You should also check her out on the Meat Improv episode 10. It's super funny. Tag Beans, thank you for listening. JDMP says these are where I'm getting the greatest improvisers on record. And that's right. They're on the record. Their words are stored forever. So we'll always know what they said. Willie Behind says he just likes it. Hey, thanks, Will. Albert Andre gives it a thumbs up. Thanks, Albert. Thumbs up to you, good sir. All right, that's it. Thank you guys for adding some reviews. If you have some time to throw in some positive 5-star reviews, I'd totally appreciate it. Anyway, that's it. Now enjoy Farley Elliott.
It's the Improv Obsession Podcast. It's the Improv Obsession Podcast. It's the Improv Obsession Podcast. It's the Improv Obsession Podcast with Stephen Perlstein.
I have to lay on my back, otherwise something will happen and it'll make a noise.
Yeah, I'm also okay. That'd be a very comfortable podcast for me of just like looking up in the stars and be like, do you think improv is silly?
Yeah. But like, aren't we all silly?
All right. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Improv Obsession Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Perlstein. Today, please welcome to the show, Farley Elliott. Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Guys, you may know Farley from the old days of improv, as I'm going to call it, former Herald Team Scandal. Mm-hmm. There was Squeeze. Mm-hmm. There were Comrades, the former host of Manifesto Show, now taken over by Penguins on the Playground. Mm-hmm.
Oh, D'Artagnan?
D'Artagnan, absolutely.
I have strong feelings for D'Artagnan. I want to get into it.
Yeah.
maybe the biggest fan.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's very nice of you to say.
Yeah.
Perennial 3-on-3 tournament losers, D'Artagnan.
Winners in my heart. And then you guys also may know Farley from his book, Los Angeles Street Food, mm-hmm. or his work writing for Food About Eater LA.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
So those are a bunch of things that... are Farley.
Yeah, one thing I think that's really cool is everybody is everything, right? Like, we all have so many different multitudes within us.
Sure.
That I can equally be a guy who is good at a job that is writing about food and restaurants that is so far removed from my time as an improviser. And I will come across people who know me as an improviser and have no idea what I do for a living, and people who know me as a authoritative voice in the food community in Los Angeles,
right,
and are shocked to hear that I've been in shows where my best friend pulls his dick out on stage. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all part of the same person.
Well, I think it's the dick thing.
Yeah, most of the dick thing,
the
people
shocking
are shocked
part.
About.
It's not like the comedy. It's like, oh, you do comedy? That makes sense. And yeah, then it's like, yeah, my friend pulls out his wiener.
My problem is I think that's what comedy is.
Oh, well, maybe that explains why we needed to walk away. All right, so let's... I guess then let's set a little bit of context then. So now, I guess when you meet people, how do you describe yourself? Like, when they ask that horrifying question, say, what do you do? I mean, I think you kind of already answered in a way, but yeah.
Yeah, I am a food writer first and foremost.
Okay.
That also, just for clarification sake, does not mean that I am a food critic. Mm-hmm. A food critic is traditionally somebody who goes into a restaurant under guise of anonymity and creates a rating system and then talks about that restaurant. I have a very cooler, I think, an easier version of that,
yeah,
which is I am a food writer. So I get to go into places and shake people's hands and help them tell their story in really interesting and cool ways. Sometimes I tell tough versions of stories where, right, a restaurant closes or something happens with a lawsuit or a place burns to the ground because of an electrical fire, all that stuff as,
yeah,
well. But I also get to tell really cool stories about the rise of Filipino food in American culture or the loss of African-American owned restaurants in South LA, things that are strong and engaging and really help to shape my own perspective on the way that I eat and the way that we all eat in the city of LA.
I'm sold. I'm very interested. Well, and I think when you spoke to the multitude of things we do, I think that's also I want to get into a little bit of why you're doing less comedy stuff these days. But that's like an interesting thing that I think is like a push and a pull for a lot of people. But especially I feel that is like doing the comedy stuff and doing I work in advertising and producing, mm-hmm, stuff. And that's great. And then I also write stuff for TV and other things. And that's right, great. And I'm like, well, what am I doing? Like, yeah, am I supposed to do one? And it is hard. I feel like it is hard to be OK with being a multi-hyphenate or something like that.
I think Los Angeles, perhaps more than any other city in America, makes that really easy and,
yeah,
almost encourages it in a certain way.
Yeah, that's true.
I, maybe a month ago, had this realization that I had spent half of my time in Los Angeles working at a day job, chasing comedy at night, writing about food when I could,
yeah,
and half of my time getting paid as a writer. And I remember when I got my first check, and the subject line for the check said I was a writer. And,
yeah,
I wanted to like definitely cash it, but also like get a scan of it and put it on my wall somewhere.
Yeah, I did the same thing for my first job for, yeah, Warner Brothers. I
absolutely
saved the check. I'm like, fuck yeah.
Yeah, there's something really beautiful about that. And to know that I'm now over the halfway point where this is how I make my living in Los Angeles,
yeah,
is really beautiful and wonderful. I did this panel not long ago for UCB with a lot of other people who have jobs outside of the comedy community.
Yeah.
And the gist of the panel was for people who are just starting or are in some level of process within the UCB world. And that notion that you have to chase comedy with everything you have, and if you're not, then you're a failure and you only deserve failure because you didn't work hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
And what I said was that it's okay to have a hobby. We,
yeah,
don't need to regret our hobbies. Comedy can be a hobby. Comedy can be something that you love with all your heart, and you can get paid for being a forklift driver. It doesn't matter. What ended up happening for me was I really got to the point where I was making a little bit of money doing comedy, going out on auditions. People would see me on stage and felt like I might be right for a role for them. And I was also making money as a writer. Food, I would travel up and down Pico Boulevard at night, eating at every taco stand I could find just to learn about the process and the regional differences between Mexican cuisine and things like that. And I got to the point where I said, what am I really getting? What's the most satisfying part of all this? And the truth was, what I really ultimately want, and this is still true now, at the end of the day, is for people to like me, to think I'm intelligent, and hopefully to think I'm funny. Okay. As long as I get those things, the end result job almost doesn't matter. I could be like the most beloved bus driver in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And if I'm getting that same level of satisfaction, great. Mm-hmm. So all I really did was transfer the things that I felt were important away from comedy and full time into food.
That's fascinating. And we're getting into it. I like it. This is good. I think that's largely true. Obviously, people get into comedy usually because they think they're funny.
Right.
Or at least anybody who sticks around usually does it because they think they're funny. Some people start because it's like, oh, my agent.
And right. Feels like a qualification.
Right. They're never really interested. And that's fine, too. But yeah, people get into it and think it's because they're funny and they'd like to play with that. And they enjoy sharing comedy with people. But yeah, like I guess it's when it becomes like the relentless pursuit of this, the 24/7 full court press on everything, you know, everything UCB sometimes or everything, you know, the big show, that can be a weird and draining, effort.
Right.
Yeah. And I just speaking for a friend who did stuff at UCB and just does not do it at all anymore. We went through class together, did some advanced, whatever. And he liked it, but he's like, you know, I didn't want to like invest all my effort into that. Like, I just like being funny.
Yeah.
I think I'm still funny. My friends think I'm funny. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, and I was like, I don't get that. How do you not try to win the game of comedy?
Right. And I'm a competitive person by nature. There is something about being within the system of any program, UCB or otherwise, where I know that the chances for advancement to the highest level are increasingly small. And I want to be the one that gets there so that I can look out and go, you did it. Love me, world, or whatever.
Right.
But all I've done is really transfer that same competitive nature to the world that I exist in now, which is primarily as a food writer. My job is to get to information before other people do when it comes to restaurants and chefs and trends. And if I'm winning that battle, I'm still winning overall.
Yeah. Hey, man, that's fascinating. In a weird way, I feel like we've solved this whole thing already.
Yeah, should we turn it up?
Not 9 minutes in, like we don't need it. Let's loop back. We might touch on this again later, but let's talk about improv or how you got started.
Sure.
I know a little bit of the story, but I'll let you retell it with the world. How'd you find your way into improv and like what was a little bit of the context before?
So growing up, I come from a really small town in northern New York and always a heavy set kid trying to like make my older brother and his friends think that I was cool. And a lot of the ways that I found to do that was by being funny. And I remember being, 13, 14, 15 years old and people would be like, oh, you're so random. You have such a random amount of knowledge or like you're so like funny and fast with things I wouldn't expect. And what I was really doing, I realized later, was setting the groundwork for what essentially an improviser is doing on stage, collecting bits of information for use later on in the most unexpected of ways. And so once it came time to start figuring out what I was going to do with my life, 17, 18 years old, I was essentially in a comedy vacuum, but I knew people. I knew, the Chris Farleys of the world. I knew the Second Cities of the world, things like that. And so I started reaching.
Not personally, just knowledge
wise in the sort of comedy zeitgeist.
Just making sure.
Yeah, no connections being made 20 minutes south of the Canadian border.
That's great.
But I knew sort of about them. And so I started working backwards. Where did this person come from? How did they get their start? And figuring that if I could follow a path similar to these comedians that I enjoyed, that maybe I would have the same level of success. So I found my first improv book was Viola Spolin's book. And I was reading it by myself in upstate New York in my bed at night, trying to figure out if this was for me and what would work. And I took a lot of that to heart, the idea of playing with honesty and the idea of group gamesmanship and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Fast forward to, 19, 20 years old. I come out to visit a friend in California who happens to be in a town called San Luis Obispo. And I just changed my life completely at that moment because the idea that I could live anywhere really happened to me there.
Yeah.
I hadn't really traveled that much or anything like that. And I just was like, oh, I'm an adult. I can do whatever the fuck I want. Like, yeah. I went back to my hometown and I left my job and I took an overnight job working essentially construction, saved all my money, moved out a few months later. And I had figured out that the college in San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly, had an improv team. And I was like, I have to get on this improv team. I've been reading these books and it became so important to me. The manager at the time of that improv team in college was Sarah Klaspel, current Cardinal Redbird member at UCB. Uh-huh. You know, she's 19 or 20 years old herself. And I am calling her from a cell phone in the bathroom of a half finished house that I lived in, being like, how do you audition? What's the process? And she's like, oh, just show up. She just assumes I was some kid from down the street, but it meant so much to me.
Yeah.
So I moved out and was available for the very first weekend of improv for this college improv team called Smile and Nod. And if I had not gotten approved that first weekend,
yeah,
I might have killed myself. Like, it was the biggest deal.
Very dramatic. Yeah, yeah, I get it.
But I was able to thankfully get on with no formal improv training other than reading a couple of books and my own sort of wit that I had devised. And then went through that entire process of short form, long form. We went to Scotland and performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Yeah. And now there's a dozen, maybe 15 Smile and Nod people within the larger UCB community down here in Los Angeles.
Yeah. A lot of cool people from that little scene too.
Yeah. The Dickie Copeland, Sarah Klaspels, Amanda Sitko, Scott Nyman's of the world, all these people.
Really great crew.
And so we all sort of moved down and kind of helped each other along. Amanda Sitko is a little bit older and she had already been taking classes at UCB. And so a lot of us fell in there. Me, Dickie Copeland, and Scott Nyman, who would later become D'Artagnan, all lived together and we just started taking classes 101, 201, 301 together. It didn't matter where it was in the city. We would drive and take our classes together. And that was the most important thing, having the backup of people that I already truly cared about and performed with to know that I could move through this process and start to get better.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of the thing that draws people into the community too, I think is, or it draws people in, is just the community part of it. Like when you start locking in with like, oh, I guess I have friends here. Like that is a weird cultish like draw in a way. You're just like, well, I can't leave. These are my friends.
Yeah. People who Dave Christensen is, I did shows with him for years. Total cult member. you know, we've undressed each other into the nude on stage before. I mean, one of the people that I would trust most in my comedy world is a guy that I met in line at UCB while I was interning on Harold Knight.
Really?
He was a groomsman at my wedding.
That's
and
great.
That's what UCB can be if you let it, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I love it. That's really, that's great. And so I guess like the, you know, let's talk a little bit about as you're getting into improv, and then you're doing it, like, what's standing out as something that you're good at the time? Or, like, maybe also the inverse of that. Like, is there anything that's, like, immediately, like, I just don't know about this? You know, your early classes or maybe even your early experience at Smile and Nod.
Yeah. So Smile and Nod was really great for me to learn how to perform in front of an audience and what to pull from and where to get laughs. But we were a self-taught organization that performed in front of kids our same age. And frankly, the barrier for entry is pretty low.
Right.
So when you go to UCB, the process is like, oh, I've got a lot of lumber to build this house, but I don't have any kind of a foundation.
Right.
So it's about building back up the things that you already know. And because in college, we would do an 8 p.m. short form show and a 10 p.m. long form show. A lot of those sort of bad short form habits are still a part of our long form shows. So I remember being in 201 with Will McLaughlin and someone was doing a scene and they said that their kids were in Jeopardy. And I literally tagged everybody out and then started playing the game Jeopardy. And Will McLaughlin was like, well, don't ever do that again.
I don't know. I think that might be a great tag.
And, you know, learning how to get beyond the joke, learning how to get to a scene and really play and live within that stuff.
Yeah. That's interesting because I do feel like there is a breed of improviser, and this isn't necessarily, I'm not trying to knock anybody on this, but I do see a lot of people coming out from like a college improv background, and it's like clearly they have some skills, especially towards being funny or being jokey too. And it, I think there's like a point where it's like, okay, are you going to drop that and like try or like, or not drop it, but like find a way to augment that with like some more foundational long form stuff or right. not. And I feel like they're like, you'll just see people just separate real quick. It's like, I'm willing to try this, or I'm like, I think I'm the funniest.
Right. Absolutely. And there's a reason that everyone still loves Convoy, because right. Convoy are people who create worlds and relationships. And that's something I was not capable of doing at any high level when I first started.
Right.
One thing that I struggled with for a very long time is the artistic nature of improv and the idea that you talk in these sort of lofty and emotional terms sometimes. Mm-hmm. It was really, really hard for me to distill out of those conversations the concrete notions that I could take away that would help me improve as an improviser.
Right.
So I would get notes from people like Billy Merritt, and they would say, oh, you know, we don't know that we felt enough out of each other in this scene. Uh-huh. Like, maybe you've got to move through with a little more joie de vivre. Like, I don't think Billy would mind me saying this. Like, I think he's at a sort of like float above the world godlike level when he talks about improv sometimes. Yeah. And that's because he got there for a reason. But I didn't always understand from him what that meant. And so it took me hearing from other people or devising for myself the personal steps that I could take that were concrete that would get me to become a better improviser.
Yeah. I mean, there is, that's, I mean, no, I agree with that. In a lot of ways, that's what this podcast is like, there is a lot of froofy talk about like the magic of improv and group mind. And I'm like, yeah, I want to do a funny scene. And you saying like, we need to create more group mind is not practical in a way.
What
like,
do I do with that?
Yeah. What? Okay, great. You need me to be able to read this person's mind more.
Right.
I can't.
Right.
Now what?
Yeah. Like, I'm no less engaged than I was when you told me about group mind. Yeah. Like, I want to know what I can do standing on the back line to make this scene the best thing that it can be.
Right.
And the thing that I always say when people on either side of my life ask me about my favorite thing about comedy is that standing on the back line of Harold Knight, thinking about what a scene needs and how you can help mm-hmm. is the most I ever use my brain in my entire life. I feel like my brain is fully activated
yeah.
in a matrixy sort of like things floating around and making connections way that never happens to me otherwise. And that is, if there's one thing I sort of quote unquote miss yeah. about comedy, it is that.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I wouldn't think that that would be something that immediately people would be like, that's the thing I miss.
Yeah.
Why?
it's the heightened it's sense of being the most engaged I yeah. can possibly be, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting too. And I'll just say like, you see a lot of bad tags and even talking about, you know, Jeopardy or whatever, mm-hmm. I'm sure now we can look at that with a little bit of a seeing why that's bad. It's like, oh, you're not helping anybody.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And there's a huge difference. There's a huge valley between, adding something funny and helping.
Yeah.
You know, that takes a lot of time to master and mm-hmm. get right. But man, it's great when you see it happen.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I have wanted to talk to you about for a long time.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think really helped me and something that I started teaching others when I was coaching improv for a while, I really started to feel comfort in this idea that everyone on stage is a genius and everyone knows everything about anything, mm-hmm. or at least five things about anything. So we all play this game, five things as a warm up, and it's right. sort of meaningless and whatever. But I think if you take it to heart,
and it's sort of stupid in a way,
sort of a stupid
time,
thing, it shouldn't be in the book, whatever. but I think if you take it to heart, what I started doing when I would coach improv is I would say, okay, you tell me five things about how a refrigerator works. People are like, I don't have any idea how a refrigerator works. And it's like, sure you do. You know that like the door opens and food's inside. You know that right. it keeps your food cold and it keeps it from spoiling. You know that there's some level of Freon in the back that keeps the thing running. You know mm-hmm. you have to plug it in to keep it going. You know that like it takes some burly man from a Home Depot to bring it to your house and set it up. Like, you know five things about refrigerators.
Right.
And if we just assume that we are tertiarily connected in at least five ways to anything in the universe, it makes everything so much easier to play. So when somebody walks out on stage and says to you, hey, dog doctor, what's my diagnosis? Uh-huh. You can go, fuck you, man. Right. Or you can go, I know five things about a dog and right. I know five things about being a doctor. So if I hang the chart up and bark a little bit, I'm halfway to being what this world needs me to be.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is creating a personalized connection that can keep you sustained. But if you, I think, can draw those concrete connections from what you know at the top of a scene, it becomes that much easier to play throughout. And I stop stressing out about feeling underqualified to even be there in the first place.
Yeah. I like that. I have, I think there's a big, I think I watch people, especially coming up, they, those questions, hey, dog doctor, what's going on with my dog? Like,
right.
They lose their mind at that, because I think it's sort of like they're making that question more complicated than it needs to be.
Right.
You know, like they're like, okay, I'm a dog doctor. I have to know everything a vet knows.
Yeah.
I have to know everything about dogs, and I have to come up with some interesting diagnosis. And it's like, no, you're adding a lot more on that question. You're adding a lot more weight on yourself and that question.
Right.
And that happens a ton. They're just like, I can't possibly know that. And it's just like, your dog's got fleas.
Yeah.
And you're like, great. Like, that's fine. That'll totally get you through this scene.
Yeah.
But it's hard, but it is hard, because I almost think of it like, what's that thing where they, lawyers, they like examine people before
cross-examination.
It's like they do it before usually the case. It's like discovery or something like that. But anyway, they interview them beforehand, and you know, they're like, one of the common example questions is, do you know the time? And the answer to that question is not, it's 3:30. It's yes. And it's like, it's sort of the difference. And that's maybe doesn't apply in improv the same way, but it's like, you're making that question more.
Oh, you think of a deposition.
Deposition.
Yes.
Thank you. A deposition. You're making that question more complicated than it actually is.
Right.
And it's because of the great, infinite number of answers that
right.
there are in improv. Whereas that deposition has, one time, people think, oh God, I can't possibly, like, I have to say the right thing. And it's like, you're just say the thing that you know. Let's
right.
make it easy for yourself.
And even in a more grounded version of a scene that you might see on Harold Knight, which is like, you're a farmer's son and you secretly have to go tell your dad that you actually want to be a race car driver.
Right.
Like, there's nothing inherently funny about the three main factors of that scene, but you know what being a race car driver entails, you know what being a farmer entails, and you know the tropes of a father-son relationship that might be hanging on a serious conversation. And as right. long as you can play with those elements like a Rubik's cube and make the different connections,
yeah.
it becomes that much easier. You know, the jokes will find a way to get there because you're obviously in UCB for a reason. You're a funny person, or you strive to be a funny person.
Right.
And that stuff will come out on its own. It's about finding ways to take the weight off yourself so mm-hmm. you can just play. And that really helped me as an improviser.
I really like that. Yeah. It's, removing the hurdles is
yeah.
kind of very important. That's interesting. I like that. Let's talk a little bit about D'Artagnan, because that's an interesting story to me.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's you, Scott Nyman, Dickie Copeland. I mm-hmm. guess y'all lived together at that point.
Yeah, we lived together 4 years, and Dickie Copeland's younger sister, now my wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
what a world.
Life's a Herald.
Yeah. I tried to marry Scott, but he wasn't having it.
Well, I think he did better than you. I'm going to say it. So that's a fascinating group. Like, you guys, it's a 3-person group, obviously self-selected in a way, partially because of a previous background you had. Mm-hmm. But I think you guys probably still like playing with each other a lot.
Totally.
I think you could definitely look around and go like, oh, these are good people that we're playing with. And you started practicing regularly with Berg. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we were very fortunate. We lived in a house, us three and one other girl. And we would, my first kind of main outside of UCB team was a team called Boomtown with a couple of other folks, most of whom are not around anymore. Mm-hmm. And we would do Boomtown for 2 hours. And then this is pre-Berg AD, so he had a lot of time on his hands. And
yep.
we would ask him a couple times a month to just stick around after our Boomtown rehearsal and just coach the three of us in 3-man improv. And we had this real notion of, we want to do something that's different. We don't want to just do a bunch of tag outs. We don't want to just sit in a mono scene. And so we started working on this form where in essentially it would be 3 sets of scenes where each of us would play 1 scene with the other 2 people. Mm-hmm. And those scenes would find ways to weave together in and out throughout, almost like a pulse
right.
over the course of a show. And hopefully by the end, we've either incorporated the people from the various scenes enough that we create 1 giant scene, or we have in some way satisfied enough of those plots or relationships to make it satisfying for the ultimate audience.
Right. It's almost short form in a way. There's an exercise like shift right, shift left or mm-hmm. something like that, where it's 4 people and it's like each pair, there'll be in a square and they rotate through and each pair has a different scene between them. It's sort of like that. That's just to help visualize it. But
yeah,
3.
Absolutely.
I mean, here's a question then. I it may sound silly, but why did you feel like the need to do something different?
You know, I think maybe a little bit was just the kind of hubris of being young and wanting to like go out on your own and do something that had never been done before. With Boomtown, we were doing what's in future iterations came to be known as the Pretty Flower as a form for a while.
Yeah.
So I think we were always trying to like expand our own personal formats a little bit. But really with D'Artagnan and our personal form, it became something that was just the most comfortable for us. We were really, really good at medium length two-person relationships. Yeah. And sometimes in my early improv career, I would come into a scene like a bowling ball and just fuck shit up. And it didn't give me the opportunity to do that for the most part.
Yeah.
And so it took a lot of patience and relying on your personal relationships with the other people to create something that would hopefully be sustainable in the long run. I also think that each of us brought something really unique to that three-person trifecta.
Yeah.
And as such, we're able to hone our own personal strengths within a format that we might not have been able to using some other format.
Yeah. That's interesting because, yeah, you guys are all different. Mm-hmm. And that all works really well, especially in that show. I've told you guys this before, but I just want to announce it publicly that I'd seen a couple of your guys' shows back at the old clubhouse way back when. And I remember like there was one that you guys did and it was just a really good show. It's like you guys, like those three different scenes, rotating, going a little bit faster as they go through all these entirely different worlds. And then weird stuff started crossing over, like the rules of one world, and kind of came into another. And I just remember like I was so engrossed in it. You know, I'd been watching improv for at least, you know, 3-4 years at this point. And when finally Dickie said the last line and they got the blackout, like I literally like stood up and cheered. Like I was like, yes. Like to the point where like other people like looked at me like, what are you so excited about? Like it's improv. I'm like, no, this is great. Like this is hard. And so I'm like just very impressed with it overall. I want to pay that compliment.
Well, thank you very much.
You guys are really great. And it's interesting too, because it's sort of worked like a Herald in a way. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like it had that, you know, that the speeding up, the crossover, the all that stuff. I don't know. It's a really interesting work that you guys did. I don't know. I really liked it.
Yeah, and I do think at the end of the day we had a sort of pace that was very Heraldy. You know, we have moments where in all three disparate scenes someone would be slapping the other person at the same moment. You know, and those all felt like group games almost, where you come together and play a singular idea, and then you back off and you slow down a little bit and you let the audience breathe, and then you'd come together and there'd be another moment like that where we're all taking one line from each other's scene and importing it into our own,
right,
and making it feel unified, and then that collection at the end. Yeah.
Is there a little first line, last line thing going on in that?
We would do that sometimes, only really when it felt super organic, but that was an early thing that we toyed with a lot.
It wasn't like a hard and fast, because I think I remember sometimes it happened and I was like, oh, fun.
And the best times we ever had, including that show that you're talking about, is pretty quickly within the three scenes, you find the one that is the strongest, the one the audience resonates with, and you sort of let the other two act as butterfly wings fluttering around that core scene and helping it in a lot of unique and individualistic but like truly helpful ways.
Yeah.
And so that by the end, hopefully those two sidebars can come together in the main way. And so you feel like, oh, the scene we cared about the most throughout this entire thing is the one that does get paid off.
Right.
And then if you can really collectivize and iron out the final details of whatever was going on in that scene right at the end, it felt like a burst of energy, you know?
Yeah, it did. And it manifested by me jumping up and making people think I'm a fucking psycho. And then I think actually that show might have been after Scandal, but I'm not quite sure. So Scandal, audition for Herald Knight. You had to be doing it for a little while before that.
Yeah, I went through the whole level of the process.
Scotty was on for like 2 years, I think.
Exactly, Scandal, right? Scott got on a team his first audition. Dickie got a callback, did not get on. Right. I did not get a callback. Felt that I deserved one, but of course everyone does. The next year, got a callback, did not get put on a team. Yeah. Was a little dismayed. Scott moved on to his second team. Dickie did not get a callback. So even then, we're sort of moving in this trifecta, you know? The third time around, Scott was on his third team in 3 years, but that team also came to include me. I was working a desk job at the time, and I got a phone call. And people in that office knew that I did comedy. I got a call from the AD and was told that I was getting placed on a Herald team, and I literally walked out. Left my office, came back the next day. I was so insane.
To what end?
To like, well, I had done this.
I'm out of here. I'll like see you tomorrow.
Yeah, it was like at 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon. It was late in the day, relatively anyway, and I just took my shit and I honestly left. But I had told, it was the only day job I ever had in Los Angeles, and I told these people when I moved there that I was like, hey, I'm going to be like a writer and a performer someday. So like, just so you know. And I always like, they kind of knew that I had that thing and that I'd occasionally do shows or whatever. So I think so I had a conversation with my boss the next day and then just tried to politely explain to them why this was such a big deal for me, you know.
Yeah.
And it got smoothed over pretty quickly, but
that's
walked
so
out.
Funny.
Yeah.
That's really funny. I had a job that I used to spend more time on the desk, and a few people knew I did comedy and stuff, and one of them kept on referencing like, I'm waiting for like our Goodwill Hunting moment where I show up and you're just not here anymore.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. Keep on waiting, man.
Yeah, it's going to be a while.
It's going to be a hot minute.
So yeah, with Scandal, I ended up getting on a fully formed team with Scott and a bunch of people, for the most part, that I didn't know. Some that I do, like Steve Slaga, I'd been performing with for a while. Ann Lane, I knew a little bit.
Lindsay Barrow.
Lindsay Barrow was new to me. Brandon Weaver.
Right?
Ali Gondour. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good little crew.
Yeah, a really great crew. And, you know, since, again, this goes back to the magic of what UCB can be if you let it. Lindsay Barrow is one of my closest friends. Scott Nyman, another groomsman. You know, Steve Slaga is a person that I have talked to and been in contact with and been within the comedy community for years at my wedding. Like, it's really cool to see what can come from a group of people who are individually working so hard to collectively come together and be something. You know, the truth is Scandal was only a 1-year team. Obviously, just like not getting a callback, you sort of feel like the team was better than only getting 1 year out of it.
Yeah.
But the things that I got out of it, the personal feeling of success and all of that stuff, really enabled me to be comfortable moving on and doing the things that I do now. If I had never gotten on a Herald team, I would be probably the worst comedy junkie still chasing that high.
You're looking at him. I'm right here. That's interesting. Scandal was good. I remember feeling like the component parts were better than the whole. I don't know if that sounds right or not, but I just remember, like, I was like, oh, there's a lot of good stuff there, but it's just not firing.
Right.
And I forgot who you guys came up with. There was another one that was new at the time. Who was the other team that was new that got added with you guys?
I mean,
you were Linseed Chandelier. Was that you or was that the other one? No.
No, we were Linseed Chandelier.
Fuck, I don't remember.
But it was, who was Mary Sasson's first Herald team?
Was it not Winslow?
It was Winslow. We came in the first year with Winslow.
Okay, yeah. I think, yeah, and I remember feeling like, oh, yeah, like Winslow seems to fit together
totally.
In a way.
And they were all friends before and they
groove.
Yeah.
Not necessarily like, oh, these improvisers are pound for pound better, but it's like that team gels, and that's unfortunate because it's like, well, you're looking at it, but I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, and then a year in, it was that like wait and see mentality of what's going to happen, and we knew that we were not necessarily a shoo-in. And I got that call, and the call was, hey, you know, there's a lot of people who stick up for you in the room, but ultimately we didn't have a spot for you, or whatever the case may be. And the moment I knew that Scandal was getting broken up, everyone starts texting each other or whatever.
Yeah.
The moment I knew the team was no longer going to be together, I knew that I probably would not be around, and purely as a numbers game.
Okay.
I think that if you're going to break up a team, keeping three members is probably too much.
Uh-huh.
You know, putting three new members on another team doesn't work. You know, diasporating them throughout the whole larger Herald community doesn't necessarily work. So if you're only going to take two people, it's like, take Scott Nyman, one of the best improvisers I know in my life.
Yeah.
And
been around for 3 years.
Yeah.
Now,
and take somebody like Ann Lane or Lindsay Barrow.
Yeah.
You know, take a female who is strong and has a presence on stage that can help another team grow. And Ann has gone on to do super amazing things.
Yeah. That's okay. Okay. So I see what you're saying. I thought you were saying that you were just like, as soon as I got the call that we're breaking up, I'm like, I'm not doing comedy anymore.
No, I would have gone on to another Herald team happily, but I knew that the numbers were not going to be in my favor, and rightfully so.
Yeah. And also I think that's the first time, anybody's used,
diasporate. Yeah.
Yeah. Diasporate. Yeah. Even like a more complicated version of that word, you found it.
I'm 80% sure it's a word.
I believe you, but it's never happened on this podcast. So good job. we gotta talk a little bit about the meat of being on that Herald team,
sure.
or whatever. So first year, I mean, like, you're going through it. What is it in your mind? Like, what's good? What's bad? Aspirations, feelings, whatever. Yeah.
I I came in at the height of my own personal love for improv. And mm-hmm. so for me, it was about jumping on board a freight train and wanting to see if I could shovel even more coal into that freight train's furnace and either shoot ourselves to the moon or get around the world as fast as possible.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a bull in a china shop with a bunch of other bulls. And that doesn't always work. You know, you need to be a person who is soft. You need to be a person who plays support. You need to be a person who's a leader, all these things. And I think I struggled individually in defining what my role was going to be. And then also understanding that that role needs to be changeable and malleable show by show. And so there's obviously a little bit of a hurdle when you first start, because there's people that I had never improvised with before, people I'd never met before. You right. get put on a team together and you have to learn about what these people bring and how you can help them.
Right.
But, you know, I had a lot of comfort in knowing that Scott was on my team and that we had such a great rapport. You know, anytime I stepped out to do a two-man scene with Scott and pretty quickly with Lindsay Barrow, it was a comfort that I felt I didn't necessarily have with everybody else.
Yeah.
Mostly for my own sake, but also because we're just new for each other.
Right.
And so the first few months are the high of doing those shows. You know, very selfishly, I made it a point to be the guy who comes out and says, hey, we're Scandal for the first time ever at our opening yeah. show. Like, I felt like I needed that in my life and really stole it from everybody else.
I need this.
But a great example of what I'm talking about is we come out to the opening, hey, we're Scandal. We do our actual opening for the show. I step out to do the very first scene, knock on a door. I believe Ali Gondour opens it. And the first words I ever said in a scene on Herald Night were, hey, faggot.
Oh, God.
Like, unbelievable. Not okay. Not an okay thing to drop opening in Herald. But, like, it speaks. And that's insane. But but it speaks to the mentality that I had at the time, right? Which is like,
you can't. Yeah, you're swinging real big.
I'm going to kick the door in. Yeah. And that's insane.
Oh no.
Right away.
Oh no.
Right away.
I mean, like, you know, I don't know, like, I'm a very strong believer, and you could probably get away, make almost anything funny.
Sure.
But man, I also know that there are things that really alienate you or can, like, really fuck you up in the audience, and not in a million years would I have the stones to have that be the first line of a scene.
First line, first Herald. Like,
you had to get a note. You had to get a note after that. Was it Berg? Berg was
Berg was our first coach. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Berg, like, hey, faggot guy.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, and that was honestly something that was so beautiful for me in going through that first time Herald Night. Is I had little touch points. I had the Scott Nymans of the world. I had Berg, who I had known and been friends with and had been a mentor for a long time, and they really helped me in that first year. I think that we did some really, really great stuff. I did think we did some really interesting work.
Yeah, for sure.
But I don't disagree with you about the idea that sometimes the components were better than the whole formed piece overall.
Which is like, and that's the thing that I find maybe the most interesting and disheartening about it is like, I guess we'll maybe transfer back into this a little bit. Sure. I think you didn't re-audition for Herald, right?
Correct.
You had good teams, you had good shows. There was no doubt in anybody's mind that you were good. I was talking to Jake Jabbour about this the other day, and he's like, yeah, like, Farley left, and people are like, yeah, like, but come back. If you want to come back, you can.
Yeah.
No, like, you didn't leave in a sense of, like, defeat. And that's really interesting to me, because that would be harder. In a way, like, that would be harder for me, or maybe not. I don't know. I was talking about this the other day. Is it harder to, like, give up when you got close, or is it harder to give up before you ever even got there?
Right.
And that's so, like, why? What the fuck, man? Like, what the fuck? People are constantly going, like, do comedy.
Yeah, it is something that I think about. And I do a very small level of comedy with my closest friends when it comes up and sort of suits me in a real way. And I think that has become something beautiful in my life and something I really cherish. So in that sense, I get a lot of personal satisfaction out of doing those shows when I do them. So am I retired? Yes. Do I come out of retirement frequently? Sure. Why not? The reasons I ended up not auditioning again and starting to fade away from that community at large was in part because I had been stung by the process and felt like I maybe deserved a little bit more, even though I had people at my back saying, do this again, you'll be on a team again, or whatever the case may be.
Right.
But I also, at the end of the day, started that personal realization journey and just saying, this isn't necessarily everything I need to be. I was never the guy who was chasing a manager or an agent. I never even really had headshots. I would go in occasionally to do an audition because somebody had seen me on stage and thought that I was a good fit for a part.
Right.
And I would get the sides and I'd practice the night before and go, I don't know what I'm doing, but I think this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'd go in the next day and I'd hear the guy in front of me doing a better job that I knew I was capable of doing.
Yeah.
And I knew that I was not willing to put in whatever amount of time and money that guy in that room at that moment had. And so instead, I shouldn't be there. So I just started walking away from it because it wasn't a thing that I realized I needed as much as a lot of other people around me did.
That's interesting. And I connect with a lot of that. Like, I haven't done a headshot in 1,000 years.
Right, yeah.
And it was taken by my dad. And I was like, yeah, it works, whatever. And it's real. And the only reason I got it was to audition for the Herald team.
Exactly.
And yeah, like, again, the same thing. It's like every now and then people like see me do stuff and like, you'd be really good for this part. And I'm like, yeah, all right, I'll do it if you need me to, but I'm not going to like learn to act
totally.
Or like get better. Like I have a number of things I can do in the acting comedy world. That's about it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try much more than that. So no, I really connect with that. That's interesting. I guess I just keep on thinking like, well, and you know, I was, at least I hope I was upfront when I said it. It's like, this is totally a therapy for me in a way, because I'm trying to figure out my relationship to improv right now.
Yeah.
And I, oh yeah. Well, I don't have any questions or thoughts.
Can I tell you
processing.
A story?
Yes,
and you
please.
Can tell me if this affects you in any way. So I
blow my head off. I hadn't told this story.
Just the thump of a microphone and the sound of me closing a door far away.
You leaving this podcast. It still goes.
It's still
out.
Going. Yeah, absolutely. Somehow it's set to automatically upload at midnight. I knew that I was never going to pursue the real world of being a comedian and an improviser in a moment. And the moment was, I had started working around town, freelancing, writing about food. It's how I was making my living. I'd made that transition, but I was still doing Manifesto Show. I was still showing up on Friday nights.
Right.
You know, I had spent years with the woman who eventually became my wife going, right. Hey, every Friday night's busy for me. Sorry, babe. And, you know, moving through that whole thing, I got to the point where I had left a job that I was on, and I was had just gotten my book deal, and I was getting up at 5:30 in the morning. I'd start writing. I'd get to Squirrel by 6:30 a.m. because at Squirrel, this is a hot tip for everyone, they don't start serving food until 8, but on weekdays they open at 6:30. You can get coffee and pastry. So I would go to Squirrel every morning and sit there at 6:30 in the morning and drink coffee and write my book.
Yeah.
And this book felt like, I'm going to have a book that's got my name on it on a shelf. That's the most important thing I could ever do in my entire life. So I would do that. And then I would go do this job all day long, writing about a bunch of other stuff. And then sometimes I wouldn't leave until 7:30 at night. And one of those nights, I had to drive to a CVS to pick up a 30 pack of the shittiest beer you can imagine, standing in line, holding that 30 pack of beer on a Friday night, working 75 hours a week, trying to get this book and everything else done, going, I'm going to take this beer that I paid for, and go stand in the back of a dark room and watch other people improvise. Mm-hmm. I don't even necessarily get to perform.
Right.
What the fuck am I doing?
Right.
And I set the beer down at the show, and we did the show. And after the show, I said, guys, I don't think I'm going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we set a schedule for me to leave. I'd been there for a couple of years, and they have done an amazing job, even when I was there, of holding that thing together.
Yeah.
But I just knew in that moment it wasn't something for me anymore.
That's really interesting. I recognize a lot of that. I live with my girlfriend here, and there is something that I both hate it when I do it, and she's an improviser comedian too, and I hate it when she does it to me. It's like, I'm going to have a show. I will not be home for 3 days in a row. I'm like, all right, that sucks. I want to see you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, and I know she feels the same sometimes, and I'm just like, by the way, my Sunday's gone. I'm just doing all comedy stuff.
Right, exactly.
And that is weird. And then, you talk about doing the indie show. I ran a show for a hot minute, and I remember repeatedly getting disappointed at the process. And I think, you know, I think I may have been getting disappointed at other things, but you know, it's like you put in a lot of effort for it. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of times it feels incredibly thankless. Like, I think you, like you said, like, I don't even get to perform or whatever. I think I usually got to perform, but I do remember going like, yeah, but I put this time and money and energy into putting on these shows, and then like all the teams just leave.
Yeah.
And they don't even try.
Yeah. And some of them don't even throw money in the bucket.
Don't throw money in the bucket. I mean, yeah. Like I still don't understand how we never made rent, because every time I go to a fucking indie show, yeah, I give them $5.
Yeah.
Like literally I've never not given $5 at an indie show.
Right.
And I don't know how there aren't people out there just doing like at least one or two, or right, like a few of them like me. And yeah, we'd usually, you know, our rent was 60. We'd be like psyched if we broke 30.
Right.
You know, it was such a nightmare. But it's just, yeah. And I think that's also too, like why a lot of teams for me have fallen apart, or like things I think a lot about it is like, I just get like disappointed in the whole process. I'm like, yeah, it seems like it'd be so nice and fun, and it's just not.
Right.
It's just not.
Yeah. And so I've fallen into a world now where I can get a dose of that when I really feel like I need it.
Right.
Or I'll invite some of my closest friends who are almost all still comedians to come have dinner at my house. And I cook everybody dinner and we giggle like schoolgirls for 45 minutes. Like, yeah, I get satisfaction in a number of other ways now that satisfy that bone that I had for comedy. And that is enough for me, for sure. See.
Well, you're funny in day-to-day life.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not, so I can't do that. We went to a Bare Naked Ladies concert, and we went to a bar afterwards. And you just regaled us with funny stories for like an hour and a half. And I was like, man, he's really on fire tonight. and I was really just sitting back, like taking your stories. I was like, yeah, I guess tell me more.
Well, there's something really funny about how it's all helped me transition into my real world life. You know, most food writers are people mm-hmm. who spend a lot of time behind a computer screen. I'm certainly one of them. And they can be a little socially awkward. Mm-hmm. And my thing is, when I was a freelancer for years, you know, you don't have a business card that says like food writer extraordinaire, trust this man. It's me and a Gmail address. And so what I would have to do if I wanted to go into a restaurant or some taco stand somewhere in South LA and help them to tell their story was to literally convince them there on the street that I was a person who should be trusted and be able to be talked to. Mm-hmm. And the only way that you can do that when you're just a guy with a Gmail address is to be the nicest guy in the room, be the funniest guy in the room, be charming, be effective, all of those things. And I would not have that skill set were it not for improv.
Right.
I still think that people who want to go on and be successful lawyers, people who want to like argue in front of the Supreme Court, I don't know, like take an improv class. Mm-hmm. You will learn very quickly.
If you want to do a deposition, take an improv class.
Yeah. When you want to ask people what time it is, take an improv class. You will learn very quickly the skills that you need to be an effective listener and an engaged speaker in a room.
Yeah. I think that I super agree with that. I think improv, ignoring any comedy benefits I ever got from it, revolutionized my life. Like, you know, I think I might have told this story before, but like Sarah Claspo and Dickie Copeland, they were on a team. We were on a team together. Argo Navis. Nope, that's not it. Styx Martin was the team. Mm-hmm. I think Sarah had just come from New York and Dickie, whatever. And like a year later, after we'd been on that team, like I was at a party and they're on the way out, they're like, they were maybe a little drunk and they're just like, we like you so much. That's so nice. Like we were just talking about how sweet you are. And I was like, that's great. Very nice. Thank you. And they were like, but when we met you, I didn't like you. And
right,
I was like, that makes sense. I'd like, you're just like, who is this overeager kid with like a lot? And I'm like, I just didn't know how to do people.
Right.
And I still think I largely don't, but I feel like I can handle it way better now.
Totally.
And that's a lot of it is just like doing the improv thing, or, you know, pretending to be a human on stage and then having to be off stage and pretend to be a human again.
Absolutely. You know? I think that people who angle themselves for performance really in a lot of ways are folks who are struggling to find those everyday aspects for themselves naturally. Mm-hmm. There are people, you know, ladies, men, or guys who are naturally good at being in a customer service world mm-hmm. who figure that out for themselves early on, never take an improv or an acting class, and they just know what they're capable of and how they can make themselves a valuable part of any group social interaction.
Yeah.
If you lack that naturally, take an improv class, take an acting class, and you'll start to find out what works and what doesn't. We're all a little bit robotic in our own minds, but getting out and being a natural, fleshy human becomes that much easier when you've got the skill set behind you.
Yeah, you gotta go get fleshy out there.
Get fleshed up, man.
I very much agree with that. I was talking to my dad about this. I was like, I think maybe school should just be like 5 years of like interpersonal skills, mm-hmm. and then like also 5 years of just like how to learn and get stuff done,
yeah.
like how to focus. And that's about all you really need.
Yeah.
I don't, most of the things I learned in high school or whatever, never need them. Don't care.
Yeah.
Not applicable to my life, but I was like, I certainly wish I would have known how to like make people like me, yeah. and like how I could focus and learn and do things better. And that's like the, I think like a deficit that I have now that I think I'm working through. And I hear a lot of people talking about things that they are working through or trying to get better at or trying to understand more. And improv doesn't hurt.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Always.
I would like to know where you stand on all this. Where are you right now in your own personal journey towards or away from improv?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm still in it, but mm-hmm. I'm hanging on by a thread in a way. Like, I've got a couple of teams that, you know, sporadically meet, sporadically do shows. Mm-hmm. Commitment level is low, mm-hmm. To, I think, everyone. And I really do, like, I envy people who have teams that meet weekly. Like, I wish I could do that because mm-hmm. I'd like doing improv. I really do. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of fun with it. And it's, I guess I'm staying in it a lot now because I want to believe that I could find that regular thing that brings that joy that I have with improv back.
Right.
Like, I think a lot about, you know, the teams that I had that were very committed, like Styx Martin or Argo Novice, where we met every week and we hung out and like that. I was like, I loved that.
Yeah.
That's a great feeling. Doing shows and bombing or doing great, I like that too.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really bother me. But now it's like, I think a lot of the community has shifted in a way towards being less committed.
Mm-hmm.
And that rubs me, and I don't know how to like navigate it exactly. And then, yeah, like I have a job, I have jobs where I make money. I have ties into the comedy world that like can be jobs and stuff that, like the type I don't really care about performing. I'm more of a writer person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that like improv is the way to become a writer.
Right.
Yeah, I really don't think that. So yeah, like there's a lot of pulls both ways that I can easily see just like, you know, fuck it, I'm never doing improv again, or going, yeah, I mean, I just will never stop doing improv.
Yeah.
And that's it's a hard thing to manage.
Do you think if you had the opportunity to get on a Herald team?
I'm about to cry.
This great. All I ever want is to like be sensitive and cry. It's the best. If you had the opportunity in this year to get on a Herald team, would you feel reinvigorated by the process and jump back in with both feet? Or would you feel on some level that it is too late for you?
No, I would be psyched. Honestly would be psyched. Like I was, I had Billy Merritt on the podcast, to talk about a similar thing. And he's like, you know, they just have to deal with a whole nother set of struggles. I'm like, I don't mind that. I don't mind the struggles. And why, in a weird way, why a Herald team has always been appealing to me is like, I get to go with maybe a better coach than I can normally get,
mm-hmm.
On a show that I know I have to do with people who have to be more committed because they're afraid of getting cut.
Yeah. The guaranteed structure.
Yeah. I was like, I love it. Like that is my dream. It's like to have to deal with all that bullshit. It's like, oh, they're going to cut you in a year. I would like that. I would like that year.
Yeah. But how interesting that the things that you describe about liking most about making it onto that team are the communal nature, the sense of responsibility that everybody shares.
Oh yeah.
And the fact that you have access to things you might not get access to. It's not even necessarily about performing at the highest level or about the things that stage might get you from a career standpoint.
Yeah. Oh, the career thing I think is a false boon or something.
Yeah.
It's just, that's not, I don't buy it. But yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's like I had more aspirations towards like, oh, I want to be on the biggest, best weekend team, teach,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's a part of me that's still very interested in that because I care enough about improv. Like I really do like improv. I love coaching. I love sharing thoughts about it and having these conversations about it, obviously. But yeah, like the community is huge and I know that. And I've like, I have tried to add more of those type of things into my life where it's like, all right, well, like here, can I find a little community that's coming together? And yeah. Yeah, you're right.
I think that's so great, you know, and I've come to a really peaceful place where, again, the majority of the people that I spend my time with are comedy people, comedians, and people that I've known even longer, people from college or whatever. And so in that sense, I still feel like I get to win. I still text Jake Jabbour.
Yeah.
Tweets that, like, I'm not going to tweet publicly, but that I think are very funny.
Wow, that's a great deal.
yeah, like, he is a person for me. We go to dinner regularly. He's a guy that I look to as, like, a beautiful shining example of, like, comedy and resilience. And I'm so thankful to have been able to be his friend for this long because he lets me sort of live vicariously through him, you know? Yeah. And he's taking his show to New York now, and he's going to be doing his show out there for a little while. Like, I think that all of those things are super magical and by extension happened to me just because I know him. Mm-hmm. And everything else is like gravy. Yeah. I don't need to worry about the bad parts, and the best parts I still get to smile about.
That's I get that. And I really do feel like that is nice and something that I could definitely slip into, and I mm-hmm. might be okay with it. But there's an interesting thing I think about it too, is like, this is such a nightmare. I'm also like, I should have disclosed it at the top. Not all of these thoughts are beautiful and perfect. Improv thoughts that
two white men with microphones in a room is like the worst case scenario to start with.
It's about the worst. And then I'm bitching about like, not, it's like, if I could just do a little more comedy. Like, I know there's way more important things in the world. Also just like, what a shitty approach and selfish approach to it. But I'll say very quickly is like, I think in a way, like, it is sort of hard to quit in that it will have all felt meaningless in a way. And it's not. I know that.
Right.
I'm not that type of person to go like, oh, if it doesn't pay off, I don't think that.
Right.
But there is a certain like meaninglessness to it that feels like, oh, well, I put a lot of effort in and I kind of never got the reward. And then I'll also add to it, like, you left with status.
Right.
If I like, people want you to come back. I think if I leave, nobody says a word.
Well, first of all, I don't think that's true. I think that you as a person within the community, the work you've done on stage and things like this podcast are all great examples of the amount of love that you have shown for this community. And I think that people would absolutely respect that. Some people might go, oh, he's that guy who, you know, had a lot of strong opinions early on or something like
Hell
that.
Yeah.
And like,
I still have.
Yeah.
Those.
You've also never been a guy who's backed down from that. Yep. And that's something that I personally respect so much as a guy who still in every facet of my life desires so strongly to be loved by everyone.
Yeah,
you have shown me in a lot of ways that it's sometimes better to be your own person in the face of that. And I think that that is really, really cool. And it makes you seem in my eyes like a very strong, independent Beyonce like man.
Thank you. I aspire to Beyonce.
You know, I'm okay with my own ego fading out of the comedy conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that the people that you talk to who say that they still want me around are friends of mine who enjoy the comedy work that I do or have done with them in the past.
Sure.
I go to UCB shows now and there isn't a single person in line or sometimes even in the box office proper that I know.
Yeah.
And those people could give a shit. I look like a dumpy 35-year-old who didn't pay full price. So like, what do they care? I have come to terms with my own sense of mortality within the legend of UCB. Mm-hmm. And the way that I still satisfy myself is by knowing the quality of the work that I did when I was around and by keeping my connections through other people. I think at the end of the day, there is a way to look at it. And mm-hmm. to your point from a minute ago, I spent thousands of dollars, thousands of hours learning how to be a part of this process, paying to be friends. You know what I mean? Like absolutely of that. And that is a dangerous and deadly way to look at it, because at the end of the day, I have been given so much more by never once getting paid to be on that UCB stage than I ever would have been able to pay in.
Yeah. I did the math. I think it was around $9,000 in improv. That could be wrong, but it was a lot.
Yeah. thousands of dollars.
Yeah. It's insane. It's like, I think if I explained that to my parents before I did it, they'd be like, $9,000 for what?
Yeah.
You said a lot. You're a thoughtful man with every sentence is so dense. That's the thing I hate. And it's also like an improv thing too. It's like when there's a sentence is so dense with information, you're like, how do I do all this?
Which part?
Yeah. So, I mean, you say like, I think you think a lot of it's your friends or people who know you who want to come back. And I think that's probably true, but also in a way it's just because this community is getting larger and younger, or maybe it's not younger, but it's getting certainly larger and people are adding to it constantly. And I feel definitely the same way about my status in my podcast. I'm still surprised that like people will tell me that they listen to it. And I'm still surprised when I'm just like, oh, like I haven't done anything in like a couple of years. Are you sure?
Right.
So that's, I get that. But you know, then again, it's the only reason that I have any type of sticking power is because my stuff was still around. The magic and the sad part about improv is like, if we could go back and we'd watch like a Farley, you know, scene, we'd be like, oh yeah, Farley's great. What happened to Farley?
Right, right, right.
I think, you know, there'd be people out there going like, why the fuck is, why not more Farley? And then you fucking said, oh damn it. Well, this is why it happens. I hate it. And I do think largely it ultimately comes down to it's an ego thing.
Yeah.
And I know that. And it's so hard to detach from your ego. It's been, I have all my spiritual books. I meditate. I try. Mm-hmm. I want it. Mm-hmm. I really do. But it is a tricky thing to do. But it just sounds like in a way it's, I don't want to like lessen it, but it does feel like a little bit like you're displacing that approval from one community to another.
Absolutely. I have a very strong need for approval in my new community. Mm-hmm. I think that the chefs and restaurant owners and the people who read my work now maybe know that or maybe don't. I'm probably a lot better at masking it these days.
Yeah.
But the truth is I want to be right. I want to be funny. I want to be beloved in a way that it matters to me.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of my trade now, I deal in daily restaurant news and larger trends and those sorts of things. If anything happens within this sort of East Side trifecta of Silver Lake, Los Feliz, Atwater Village, Echo Park, mm-hmm. Highland Park, and I'm not the first one to write about it,
yeah,
it'll fucking chat my ass for a day because I'm as competitive as I ever was. Yeah. And I want to be the person that everyone has to look to as the guy who gets it right.
Right.
And I will always feel that drive and devotion. It's just, what am I pointing it at this point? Mm-hmm. You know, 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, I might be a person who is doing television shows about food with a comedy bent, and it all kind of comes full circle in a way.
Right.
And even in that world, whatever it would end up being, I would want to be doing better than all the other people around me because that would mean that I'm doing it right.
Yeah, I get that. Also, like just briefly too, you mentioned like the ingredient a food show and a comedy bit. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's the thing that's very interesting about media right now and all of it is that it can be very mixed and it takes a very specialized person. I think it's less frequently now, you know. A handsome guy, like you think of it like this, it's like 50s. It'd be like a handsome guy to talk about food. Like that's about it. It's not like it's going to be a great food expert. It's going to be some guy.
Right.
And now it's like, no, there are people who are fucking hyper specific and all the deep knowledge that they can bring or the deep experience they can bring to a job or the future career. And I definitely think I'm like, man, I've got an eclectic resume. I wonder what weird thing. And it does all kind of come together. And I love that. Yeah. It's interesting. You've got it. Oh, no, I want to talk to you about food, but I'm not going to do that.
Let's spend like 5 minutes talking about food.
OK,
it's my new favorite thing to do. So
OK, I think I found the best two types of restaurants.
OK,
and I want to see. I don't know. I don't even know because I feel like you do a lot of tacos and stuff. So these might be things you do.
Well, let's hear it. I'm excited.
Ramen.
OK,
what's the best ramen?
I mean, this is a largely Los Angeles audience, right? We can talk about things in LA specific lose a lot of people.
It'd be less Los Angeles than you'd think, it's okay. Yeah.
Got it.
They'll be okay.
Well, speaking on a more macro scale, mm-hmm. there is a place on Sawtelle Boulevard in West LA here called Sujita Ramen. And then they have a Sujita Annex, which is across the street, which is sort of exclusively ramen. Sujita does other Japanese specialties like trashy bowls and things like that. Mm-hmm. Sujita is probably within the top three best ramen places in all of America. You know, you look like Ivan Ramen in New York,
really?
Great contender, things like that. They do a style of very dense, very pork heavy, very long, strong kind of springy noodles that is basically unrivaled outside of Japan. And what you are seeing is Los Angeles is a super hot city right now for restaurants. And we have a lot of things going for it. We have low price per square footage for space. We have a great influx of cheap and available labor, cheap and available produce. And most people in places like Tokyo or Sydney are struggling against government regulations that don't allow them to do the type of thing they want to be doing in that place. And Los Angeles is a super cool, available melting pot and a first stepping stone for America.
Right.
So some of the best Japanese, some of the best Japanese restaurants, ramen people are coming to Los Angeles. Some of the best bartenders in Sydney, Australia are coming to Los Angeles. And so there's never been a better time to explore the city's dining scene and look at it through the lens of how does this place we already have compare to what's back there? Because pretty soon we're going to have the best of everything.
Yeah. Which is how I feel about improv.
Yeah.
You're going to have the best of everything real quick. I'm a pescatarian too. So that mostly leaves me in the very, very minor leagues about any conversation about food.
Sure.
And that's why ramen has always been tough because it's hard to find a really good and I'm a very flexible pescatarian, vegetarian, whatever. And it's fine. It's hard to find one that's not like lathered in pork.
Are you definitely no chicken?
No, I mean, I'm not.
You're not super hardcore.
I'm not dogmatic about it. Yeah. Here's the thing. It's like, I go to Tatsu a lot.
Yeah.
I think that is, I've had a lot of other ramens, especially vegetarian ones in LA, and none of them have even come close. And I'm just like, did I find like the first ramen I ever tried was Tatsu. And I'm like, on my first try, did I have the best ramen?
Right.
And I'm super curious about that. So I'm like willing to go try some other, like more meaty shit. If it's like really good.
Right.
I want to experience the best.
I think if you go eat the pork tonkatsu ramen at Tsujita on Sawtelle, it might give you that outlook that you're looking for. Daikokuya downtown in Little Tokyo is another great example. You know, this is the thing with Daikokuya that I would say, and I think a lot of people would say, it's very easy to be the first, be the first person to bring a really authentic style of Japanese ramen to Los Angeles. It's very hard to keep being on top after being the first.
Yeah.
Daikokuya is a little bit more of a legacy pick now than it is like best ramen in LA or something. You should also try Ramen Hood at Grand Central Market. They're an all vegan ramen option. That a lot of people do like, you know, and it's going to be a different experience, but
points for a pun.
Love a ramen hood.
Great. Okay. And then my other category of restaurant, and again, I don't know if you have any experience. It's okay. Poke.
Oh, interesting. Like, you must be living large right now. I mean, poke is one of the largest current trends in Los Angeles.
So there's a lot of places coming up. There's one open up in Larchmont very close to me pretty soon. Mm-hmm. I think it's a Sweetfin, which is a chain.
Sweetfin is among the best, I would say, for sure.
Okay. Not my favorite.
Yeah. I mean,
the best is, in my opinion, is Ohana. Poke is
interesting.
The best one. And I've been to several around LA because again, pescatarian, I run, I do just a little bit of working out. I need some protein sometimes.
Sure.
So I love going to Poke. And if I can find one that's good, but again, Ohana was like one of the early ones I went to. And I'm like, nothing's better than this.
I definitely like Ohana. Have you been to the Silver Lake location where they do the Poke burritos now?
You know what? I've seen that on the menu and I'm afraid to adventure.
Like, you know, it's pretty good.
I bet it is.
It's a little bit of like a wink and a nudge of like, look what we did, but it is pretty good. Absolutely.
I usually go to the Silver Lake.
Yeah. Have you been to Mainland on West 3rd?
I have. Mainland's good. I guess what I don't love about it is like, I get why they're like doing it Chipotle style in a way, but I want them to make it. You know what I mean?
Totally,
I'm not like, you guys don't get it. I don't know what good poke is.
Right.
I want you guys to make me a good thing.
Yeah.
And I'll tell them, like, you know, just, I don't know, what do you think works? And they'll tell me and whatever. But it's still, like, in my opinion, I don't think it's ever been as good as Ohana.
That's so funny. See, one of the things I like about Mainland the most is that they operate a lot of, even Sweetfin, they've got these pre-prepared bowls and they pre-marinate a lot of their fish. And sometimes that can really break down the fish, especially if you get sauces that are super acidic. Whereas Mainland is super fresh fish every single day. And they go about the process of physically sauce and all making those bowls right in front of you.
Yeah.
So if you're a person who doesn't have a strong opinion one way or the other, I totally get what you're saying. Mm. But I think from a quality perspective, they're pretty hard to beat. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to go back into it with another, my eyes opened.
Right.
I'm going to try it again.
And the one thing I would say too, with food and with improv, is I always try to talk in high percentage and low percentage choices, right? You talk about there is room for anything to be funny on stage.
Yeah.
You could talk about
hey faggots, a low percentage.
Yeah, yeah. Hey faggots is a low percentage choice, but I could get in a room where that kills. Yeah, wasn't Harold Knight, but there is a room where that kills.
It wasn't my debut.
Same thing with food, right?
Yeah.
There are places that you and only you will like, or you and a handful of people. There are a ton of dishes. Jonathan Gold talks about this. He will on occasion go back to places and eat the weirdest thing on the menu and go, this sucks. And then start to have that realization of, this doesn't suck, I suck. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to think about this to know that it's good. And it's obviously good because I look around and everybody else is ordering it.
Right.
And so sometimes you have to admit that you're the one who's wrong, you know?
Yeah. And that's interesting. I'll type quickly back into the improv thing and then we can wrap it up here. But I was like, a thing that has embittered me lately, I'll fully admit, is like not understanding why some people will move up and some people won't. And it's just, it becomes a taste thing. I'm like, well, I believe X, Y, and Z are great improvisers, comedians. And for some reason, they're not being recognized very much.
Right.
And then I see, you know, these A, B, and C, and I'm like, they're fine. They're okay. And then it like move up and I'm like, how the fuck is this happening?
Yeah.
And that is very confusing. That's a very challenging thing because you start going, what, do I not fucking know what's funny anymore?
Right.
Is this whole notion of like that I think I'm funny and I have good taste, can I not even trust my taste anymore?
Right.
That's a nightmare.
Yeah. And you know what? In the same way that the thing that I love to feel the most is the love of other people, no matter what genre I'm experimenting with it.
Yeah.
I have the same fear now in a food writing world that I did as an improviser, which is at some point somebody's going to turn the music down and everybody in the room is going to look at me and one guy's going to go, that guy doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. And everyone's going to go, yeah, get him.
Yeah.
Like, you feel like a fraud forever.
Yeah.
And I think that never really leaves. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with chasing in the front this desire to be loved and getting run through in the back by the desire to not be found a fool.
Yeah. I very much feel that. And I really do. I very much feel like, do I not get this? Am I not funny at all? Have I never, ever done a scene right? Is that possible? Have I been being carried by every single moment?
Right.
In my experience, the only people who don't seem to have that or don't seem to feel it are the worst.
Absolutely.
Like really just, it's like they don't have any idea of how bad they are. It's like, well, I'm killing it. And you're like, you're the least funny person I've ever seen.
Yeah. And the reason you're the least funny is because you don't know that you're the least funny.
Yeah. It's a real catch 22 for that.
Yeah.
All right. I have a couple wrap up questions I like to do.
Great.
Side coaching, yay or nay?
Nay.
Okay.
I believe my personal belief, and this is a big thing for me when I was going through the community, was be allowed to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And part of side coaching means that you're never truly failing in real time because you're constantly getting the updated note. Mm-hmm. And so I would rather burn out spectacularly and know what that feels like than be told it's okay, do a better job, and here's how next time.
Yeah. There is definitely something to feeling a failure.
Yeah.
Although it's hard, like I did one, I was just trying to get these guys to do more. It was a while ago. I was coaching a team. I was like, just add more specific information. Just don't worry. It doesn't have to be funny, but just add something specific.
Right.
We're doing 3-line scenes. And I'd be like, all right, we have to vote after every scene. Do you want to see more of that scene? I was like, just add more information. And they're still like, hey, how are you?
Right.
I'm good. And then I was like, and they'd all be like, yeah, we want to see more of that scene. I'm like, you really want to watch more? Hey, how are you? Weather's good. Fuck that. It's hard, but that feeling, I want that. Yeah, I agree. That feeling is an important one. When you're just like, I never want to fail again.
Yeah. And there's also, as a quick sidebar, one show that I did pretty early on in my indie improv career, a 2-man show with Dave Christensen. We did an improv show where it was only the host in the room. The host got up and said, all right, here's your next team, David and Goliath, and walked out of the room. The only two people on stage or in the room were Dave Christensen and I. No one else there. No audience. The host left the room. We just talked to each other for 10 minutes. Two friends on a stage, nobody around, not even the lighting guy.
Good God.
And so at that moment, I was like, this is the worst possible outcome. This is the worst thing that could happen.
Yeah.
And so now that I've hit that bottom in a way, I'm fine with growing up because it's never going to be worse than this. And you lose that if you're side coaching sometimes.
I get that. was the Marcus Aurelius, like, is this so what I so feared? Like, there's, you know, experiencing the worst possible outcome. And it's like, well, what then? Now what? Exactly. Is my life so ruined? Probably not. That's interesting. I love it. Okay. I'm going to ask the inverse of this question, so don't get too panicked. What do you hate seeing in improv, or what, when you see it, bothers you?
The things that continue to bother me after all these years are people who don't seem authentic. I love a lot of different types of character choices and a lot of big different types of scenes. I will always be a sucker for broad comedy, for a sucker for people falling down on stage or pulling each other's pants off, whatever it is, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's nothing really silly about that that appeals to me. But the stuff that I can't get behind is when people don't seem to believe the thing that they are saying in real time. It's hard to quantify sometimes. Like, it's hard to point it out. You sort of have to just be in the moment to notice it. But I have been in lots of scenarios, either on stage or witnessing people who feel distanced from the thing that they're doing. Maybe it's an aside or an elbow to the audience or a little wink, wink nudge or, you know, some sort of giggle to their friend on the back line. And that stuff is just a killer to me.
The lack of commit or just willing to, I think there's a type of thing of like trying to show the audience that you're not doing that.
Yeah. I came here to believe and you're not letting me do that.
Yeah. And I'm guilty of it frequently. It's a tricky skill to master. Okay. Then what do you love seeing in improv? What's when you see it, what impresses you?
The thing that I love in and out of improv, but I love especially seeing on stage is
people saying my name. Farley Elliott is great.
Is people just jerking it to photos of me. Is the inverse of that. It's similar to your question. You know, I think Work Gross with Gillian Nassim is a show that is of Jake's large creation. And one of the reasons I respect Jake as an improviser so much is because he challenges himself on stage to be as honest as possible and then follows through on that challenge. We have this thing with a bunch of friends from Squeeze that we've been doing for a long time, which I call best pitch, worst pitch. Uh-huh. The idea is if you're all in a group, everyone does, it's like you're trying to get the job interview. What can every other individual person in that circle say about you that would help you nail that job interview? Stephen Pearlstein is a super thoughtful guy. Stephen Pearlstein gives so much back to the improv community. And then when it gets to you and you have to talk about yourself, you have to say the single worst thing that would make you lose that job interview. That's like
what a nightmare. I love it.
Yeah. It's like I once jerked off to the Lando Lakes girl, like whatever it is.
That's so
funny. And there's something about that honesty that appeals to me in a way that is pretty unstoppable.
Great vulnerability is impressive.
Yes.
This is a different thing that I'll reference, but it was a sketch from Big Grande. Did you hear about this one that they were like, they played their own girlfriends and then they said, you know, embarrassing things about themselves and then let the other ones react to it. And I guess some of it was improvised or whatever. Man, I was like, that is a brave and very funny act.
Totally.
And that's still talked about. Still, like, it's a very impressive thing. I totally agree. Okay. Last bit, I guess, of the show. Pearl of wisdom, note or feedback you got in your improv career that they thought was interesting or impactful?
I would say it would probably have to come from Berg in one of his semi-lucid states of talking about the like the confluence of improv and theoretical thought or something.
Right.
But he would, I can't even think of the name of this thing, but someone has built a box of some sort that depending on which angle you look at it from, it shows you different things, right? Like you shine a shadow on this side of the box and it looks like a cutout of a man and a woman kissing. You shine a light on this side of the box and it looks like a trash heap, whatever it happens to be. And whatever that box is called, and Berg will hear this and yell at me for not remembering, is that idea that and this is a great tie into the very first thing we talked about. We are all multitudes. That box is the same, but depending on which angle you're looking at it from, it is an entirely different perspective and awareness. So within improv, it's about setting those three or four corners and providing a base reality and then playing the different locations so that you can be all these different things and create a fully formed, realized character. For me personally, it's the exact same thing. Yeah. I am different things to different people and I'm proud of every one of those in a different and beautiful and unique way.
Yeah. I love it. I feel very strongly about that, especially in the personal life. It's just like, I went to South by Southwest, mm-hmm. and that was such a fun time. And I met all kinds of interesting and creative and people, different people from all kinds of different industries and careers. And I was like, it's hard because I'm constantly relating to them in a different way. I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, well, I actually do comedy a lot too. We're talking about comedy. And then the next person I'm talking to, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. How do you feel about new age advertising and right. all this stuff? And it's all over the place. And it's like, yeah, that is really what it is. It's just a matter of perspective on it. I don't know how that exactly relates to improv. You're just saying like putting it all together, like putting all the...
I think for me, it's about finding the three or four core things, right? Mm-hmm. The five things we know we can talk about. Finding right. those core things and making those the backbone of the scene, just like we would do with D'Artagnan. This mm-hmm. is the backbone of this through line. And then finding different ways to explore and look at those things.
I see.
So, you know, we're a couple going on a hiking trip and we're sort of lost. And then what are all of the possible scenarios that come to that scene because right. we've established the backbone?
Right. Okay, that's very interesting. And I like that because, yeah, shining a light on it different. Also particularly resonates with me because it is easy, especially early. We're talking about Lost. I didn't bring the map. And then all we fucking talk about is the map. That's the worst version of that scene because it's like, I don't give a fuck about the map. I'm interested in this relationship and how else can we explore this situation? How else can we find out more about it? And the only way to do it is to stop talking about the map and then talk about the compass. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I love it. Well, Farley, that's basically the end of the show, except for plugs. I mean, obviously, we want everybody to see your book, Los Angeles Street Food. Buy it.
Yeah, you can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it at places like Skylight Books and Los Feliz, all sorts of spots. It's called Los Angeles Street Food, A History of Tamaleros to Taco Trucks. It's equal parts the history of how we got to where we are as the only true street food city in America, and also mm-hmm. places to go and things to explore for yourself. I'm also the senior editor at Eater in Los Angeles, so I write daily about food and restaurants and all sorts of fun stuff. And otherwise, just go to Squirrel. You'll see me.
Yeah, he's there. Also, speaking of South by Southwest, I saw a keynote thing from the owner of Vox, which is owns Eater.
Yes.
And that was such an interesting thing. And he talked a lot about getting people who are passionate about the thing writing about it. He talked a lot about sports journalism. And his example is like, you know, it used to be cold, dry reporting of the facts. And it's... that's not that interesting until we changed it to people who care and know a lot about it.
Yeah.
Like they're pissed and they're both pissed at and love the Patriots for whatever the hell.
Totally.
And I think that's a really great angle. And I think, that's definitely something you bring and something that hopefully everybody brings to their work. I don't know, across the board, right? Bring that passion.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, man.
I love it. All right. Thanks, Farley. Have a good thing. I was going to say, have a good day.
I will have a good day. Yeah. And I just want to commend you for finding ways to plug the fact that you went to South by Southwest. Took 120 minutes, but we got there.
Yeah, yeah. Check me out at South by Southwest. I don't think I posted a single thing on Instagram. I was there. There's no record of it, but I have to tell everyone.
Can't wait.
All right. That was Farley Elliott. For more information on the things we talked about, including show notes and brags about how I was at South by Southwest, go to boardwalkaudio.com/improv-obsession. There we'll have links to Farley's internet presence, as well as mine. You'll also have the option to support the show by shopping on Amazon. You go to boardwalkaudio.com/improv-obsession, click the support our artist buttons, and you shop on Amazon. Buy the stuff you'd normally buy. Buy Farley's book. And a small percentage of that purchase goes to us. Easy, free, help support the show. Don't forget to subscribe, add a nice little review, reach out for coaching. All that stuff's easy to do. At boardwalkaudio.com/improv-obsession. We'd really appreciate it. Anyway, I guess that's it. For now, happy improvising.
This has been a Boardwalk Audio podcast. For more information and shows,
Hey, everybody.
Do you like getting stoned and watching a movie?
Or just watching a movie?
Well, then check out our podcast,
IMD Weed,
where we...
and a guest...
go to the movies and discuss it after.
A movie review podcast with a little token twist, get it?
Oh, boy. But hey, you don't have to smoke weed to enjoy this podcast.
You should enjoy watching movies, though.
Subscribe to IMD Weed on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app.